Please be advised that this story touches on issues relating to mental health and suicide,
which some listeners may find upsetting.
Hi, we should probably introduce ourselves. I'm Micah.
And I'm Sydney.
And this is a podcast called Conversations with Sydney.
That's me.
Today, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Terrence Roberts, a teenaged hero of the civil rights movement, about his sources of resilience in the face of racial hatred and violence.
I must say, I felt fear at a level I'd never felt before. I didn't even think it was possible for human beings to be that afraid.
Recording in progress.
Hi, Dr. Roberts. Could you please introduce yourself?
I am Terrence J. Roberts, and I most often go by Terry. I was born in Little Rock in the year 1941. At that time, race was the ultimate element. It was like water in a river. It was everywhere, all the time. And the mantra was separate but equal. Now, of course, it was always separate, but never equal. For instance, as a black kid, I was not allowed to go into the public library. I couldn't go into many places. The few places I could go into were restricted. If I wanted to get a hamburger, I could go to a window, or I could go to the back door, or, as in the case of a little place called the Crystal Burger, I could actually walk inside, but I couldn't sit down. No black people were allowed to sit down. I guess I was about 12 or 13. I walked into the Crystal Burger, and I knew the drill, that you stand and wait, and you get food to go. This particular day, I forgot the rules. My mind was wandering. Very few people were in there. All of these empty seats, bar stools were open. So I decided I would just sit on a stool and wait. Now, the minute I sat down, I remembered the rule. The cooks, the waiters, the patrons, they all stopped what they were doing and turned their attention to me. Well, I jumped down off the stool. I paid and took my food and ran out of there. And I was crying and really upset. And I ran home and ran in the house. And my mom sensed that I was having a moment, and she didn't bother me. She let me percolate for a while. Then we talked about it. She reminded me that we were living under this cloud of segregation. And I want you to always know that whatever happens out there, none of it has anything to do with you. But what other people are doing are telling you who they are. So you need to pay attention. You need to be alert. You cannot allow your emotions to override your common sense, because you could wind up getting killed. You have to be aware that black men, particularly, have been lynched for no reason whatsoever. You have to know that. You have to understand that that puts you in that category that you too could be lynched if you weren't careful. There were 7 kids, and we all got that same message. We were learning from day one how to be black in Little Rock with the cloud of segregation hanging over us and all that that meant.
In 1954, the Supreme Court passed Brown versus the Board of Education, a landmark case that declared that state-sponsored segregation in public schools was unconstitutional.
3 years later, local organizers in Little Rock asked for volunteers to attend a historically white-only high school and challenge segregation in the South.
I had my hand up immediately when the call for volunteers came. I was excited, no question about it.
Terry was 15 years old.
Did you talk to your parents about the risks? I mean, you were putting yourself in a fairly dangerous situation.
Yes. So when I came home and told them I had volunteered, without hesitation, they said, "We will support you 100%. And if you get up there and it's too hot, you want to quit, we will support your decision to quit 100%. And I didn't really understand how important that last part was, but it was the part that actually allowed me to stay, because I knew I had permission to leave. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. came to Little Rock to talk with the nine of us, mainly to discuss the philosophy of nonviolence.
Nonviolent strategy embodied both the ethical principle that violence was morally unacceptable, as well as a tactical recognition that nine teenage students could never match the violence of the racist system that was aligned against them.
He was a very young man at that time, very early in his ministry. And, you know, he talked with us about the fact that it was a dangerous situation and responding with violence would simply make it more dangerous. You have to consider being nonviolent. Then he gave us 24 hours. Go home, think about this, and if you can come back tomorrow and say, in truth, that you love your enemies, then we can do this. Now, we were young and we said, yes, we can do it. None of us knew exactly what we were saying yes to. And there wasn't really time for us to have any training. We didn't have any, honestly, because things were happening too fast. But we did say we were going to be nonviolent. And in the main, we adhered to that. There were some times when we weren't nonviolent, but we don't speak about those a lot. Destroys the image, you see.
Can you describe to us what happened on your first day at Central High School?
The first day of school at Central was early in September 1957, and we were aware that the governor had called out the National Guard, ostensibly to keep the peace, he said. I walked to school that day. I lived about six blocks away. And as I approached the school, I could hear the clamor of the crowd, the noise. I got up there and I saw one of the largest crowds of people I'd ever seen in my life. And they were all around the school. And then I saw the National Guard, and they were positioned shoulder to shoulder in a line all around the school. You couldn't get through unless they moved. And I saw white kids streaming through a break in the line, and I thought, okay, that must be the designated point of entry. So I walk over, but then when my turn came to enter, they closed ranks. Didn't say anything, just looked at me, stared at me, really. None of us were able to get through. It took about 3 weeks for us to have another attempt. On the second attempt, the governor threw up his hands, literally, and said, okay, do it, it's on you, to the president, who was Dwight Eisenhower at the time. The protection we had that day was the Little Rock Police Force. In retrospect, our choice to go up there was not a good one because, you know, the mindset of the police, some of them joined the mob that day. And we were inside the school and the mob broke through the line and there were a few policemen who were willing to help us get out. And fortunately, there was an underground garage in the school. So we got down in the basement, jumped into a couple of squad cars and got out of there. A lot of things happened to alert Eisenhower that he had to do more. So he finally sent in the 101st Airborne Division, and they came. Then we got in, and each of us happened to be escorted from class to class by an armed soldier. That was pretty surreal.
You're 15. There are people clamoring to kill you. How are you handling that stress?
Well, I must say, I felt fear at a level I'd never felt before. I didn't even think it was possible for human beings to be that afraid and still remain standing. Yet all nine of us were able to do that. My thing was, I was not going to allow fear to dictate my choice. Now that was not easy. That was not easy because I felt an urge to run at every second. But another voice in my head said, you have the right to be here because the law has changed. The law is on your side. So it was this ongoing internal debate about what I should do. And I kept saying, I'm going to do it. I'm going to stay. Maybe I'll get killed. I don't know. I mean, that was uncertain. None of us knew. I mean, every day we thought one of us or all of us would wind up on some coroner's list at some point. But fortunately, we all made it through. I use a lot of internal mantras. I recited poetry. One in particular is a poem called Invictus. Out of the night that covers me black as a pit, from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. At that time, that was so relevant. I pretty much knew that every day was going to be a real trial. But my real focus was on learning, believe it or not. And that learning included not just the academics or the curriculum, but learning about myself and learning about other people around me, other kids. You know, because as you watch other kids and how they operated, you pretty much knew what to expect from them. So it gave me an advantage. I didn't have to wait for them to act. I could anticipate what they might be doing. And I could stay there or leave, you know, just depending upon my choice. Now, making it my choice always meant that I was in control, and that helped a lot. I wasn't at the mercy of others, even though they wanted me to be.
While federal troops remained at Central High School the entire year to protect the black students, there were often times when Terry still found himself alone.
For instance, I could be in the hallway, and if these kids felt they could get away with it, they'd start punching me, you know, and I wouldn't do anything. I just wait for them to stop. But then all of a sudden, in most of those cases, they would get to a point where they would refuse to throw another blow because they realized that some deep-spotted within themselves, this wasn't fair. This is unfair. I mean, it takes a real hard-headed person to keep punching when you're not punching back. And they would just walk away. Then I would say, aha, they're walking away, losers. I'm standing here, the victor. Even though I'm the bloodied and bruised one. See, that mentally, that makes a difference. That makes a big difference. It's hard to do. I won't say it that's easy. But once you do it and you begin to understand what internal resources you have, you rely on those and they become stronger. You become stronger as an individual.
The following year, Terry had to finish high school in Los Angeles, California, after Little Rock's white residents voted to close Central High School instead of allowing black students to attend school with whites.
But Dr. Roberts and the other members of the Little Rock Nine had already become national symbols of resistance to institutionalized segregation, and they helped to hasten its end.
Too often, I think young people on social media get so confused because they read stuff that includes their name and they think this is about me. It's not. It's about other people being who they are. They don't even know who you are. I think the big difference between our generation and those who came after us is we learned how to be resilient very early in life. And we weren't willing to allow, say, the system of segregation to dictate who we were to be. And our part was to be image bearers to other people, to let them know that it is possible to obey the law.
Today, we were speaking with Dr. Terry Roberts, a member of the Little Rock Nine, who desegregated Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas, in 1957.
And this is Conversations with Sydney.
Hello, that's me.
This program was produced by Common Good Productions
in association with WBGO Studios.
Conversations with Sydney is a part of WBGO's Voices of Wellness, made possible in part by a grant from the Horizon Foundation for New Jersey.
If you are having thoughts of suicide, please call or text the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988.